Coming up on Golf Today, proud Vermonter, proud New Englander Keegan Bradley takes a break from the post-victory party to talk with us about winning close to home and being one of the best players in the game again. And how about a visit from Zach Blair? He also had a great week at the Travelers, but what does he enjoy more, playing great golf or building great golf courses? And Peter Jacobson, our colleague and friend and voice of the game, hops on to chat about this week's U.S. Senior Open, which he's won. Hey, it ain't bragging if it's true on Golf Today.
Golf Today.
Golf Today on a Wednesday. Damon Hack alongside Eamon Lynch, Golf Week magazine. These days, folks, you keep one eye on the golf course and one eye on the old AP news wire.
Yeah, we've heard that a week is a long time in politics. It seems like a day is a long time in golf these days, certainly as the sands seem to shift all the times in terms of the broader politics of the game. Yesterday was no different. There was a PGA Tour board meeting yesterday, and at the conclusion of that board meeting, the PGA Tour released a statement from that policy board, which includes five independent directors and five players. And it said, entering the framework agreement put an end to costly litigation. The framework agreement, of course, being the deal with the Public Investment Fund of Saudi Arabia. Management, with input from our player directors, has now begun a new phase of negotiations to determine if the tour can reach a definitive agreement that is in the best interest of our players, fans, sponsors, partners, and the game overall. That was the focus of our productive policy board meeting this afternoon, with valuable and crucial input and perspective from the membership through our player directors. If future negotiations lead to a proposed agreement, it would need approval by the Tour's policy board, which includes player directors. In the meantime, we are all committed to the safeguards in the framework agreement that ensure the PGA Tour would lead and maintain control of this potential new commercial entity. We are confident that the Tour's mission will continue to focus on showcasing the game of golf while serving its local communities. You know what I take from that, Damon, is two things. There, in two separate paragraphs there, the word if carries an awful lot of weight. It's if the Tour can reach a definitive agreement and if future regulations or future negotiations lead to an agreement. There's a lot of doubt in there because there really aren't any details to offer on this agreement yet. But this statement was extraordinarily deferential to the player directors. Mm. It's almost as though the board has been reminded where the real power in this organisation rests. And it rests with the players. And you'll hear a lot of players, I think, talk about, in general terms, about how they're on the right track, or at least there's a conversation going on and we'll see where it goes. They're not all on the same page, though. Patrick Cantlay is very clearly not on the same page as the rest of them. He's one of the five player directors on the policy board, along with Rory McIlroy, Charlie Hoffman, Peter Malnati and Webb Simpson. And I think what this agreement is at pains to point out is that the players will have an ultimate say in this, and that the board will vote as the players wish them to vote. But of course, as of now, with no details really out there as to what it's going to look like, no valuations on any of the assets, anything like that, there's nothing really for the players to object to at this point. So it's trying to set a clean slate because the players had bruised feelings that they were left out of the fact that these discussions were even happening. It's trying to smooth over that and try to lay the pathwork for what might come, which could be some more angst in the future as well.
Yeah, I took some similar things away. You used the word if that we heard a lot in that statement. Proposed, potential, negotiations. Those are the words I wrote down. There's still so much yet to be determined, including the results of this Department of Justice inquiry, this congressional inquiry as well. I do wonder if you feel, though, because I feel this a little bit, much in the same way that Jay Monahan and the PGA Tour went from adversary potentially to partner. Just the passage of time, the weight of the money that the Public Investment Fund has. I just wonder if in this merger that the PGA Tour and the folks are hoping, just with the passage of time, everything becomes more palatable and we move on to other things. The early outrage that we saw just begins to wane and the players finally say, you know what, maybe this isn't so bad. And those player directors that you're talking about that are going to be the ultimate in saying that they want to go vote this way or not, they're just beaten down by time. And they're just beaten down by the cash. And say, you know what, let's just do this so I can tee up my ball and play golf.
Yeah, the anger will dissipate. And the anger that we saw in the immediate aftermath of the announcement on June 6th was really about process, not the policy of where they're
right.
going. It was the fact that these guys were left out of the loop, which in a way is understandable, because if you tell a tour player anything, the world is going to know within 10 minutes. That's why we're in the business we are of talking to these guys. But in time, I think they will find more to object to. There are a couple of perilous potholes for the tour in this. They've already sacrificed in terms of the moral argument. That didn't win the day here. The tour has done an about-face on it. It's not part of the discussion internally on the tour. It might be for fans and others. It's not a part of a discussion that players and tour officials are going to have. But there are some key points. For instance, how do they recycle the LIV guys back into whatever the tour ecosystem is going to look like a year or 2 years from now? What are the penalties to get them there? That's going to be a very difficult thing to get past players who feel as though they might have had an opportunity to cash out, didn't, and now these guys are walking back with money. That's going to be a very difficult negotiation. But the money is a big thing here. This promise in this agreement that the Saudis are going to festoon them with cash, which is really all that matters. But as we talked about here yesterday, the problem fundamentally with this agreement is that if it doesn't come to pass, if the negotiations don't quite get there and the DOJ has a say in reshaping this, then the tour doesn't get any of that money. And that's what the tour is clearly in pursuit of with this agreement. They have given up all the legal leverage they had. They can't make any moral argument anymore. What they were in pursuit of was the cash investment from the Saudis. And if this agreement doesn't happen, the tour is not going to have the cash, possibly even to sustain the business model that currently exists that players have demanded. So that's going to get a lot of players on board alone, is what's the alternative to this deal. Because if you're focused on cash, the way the terms of this deal has been written, they're just not going to paint a pretty picture for guys who are focused on cash if it doesn't happen.
So many unknowns. We don't even know if we're closer to the end than the beginning. For more from this week's PGA Tour stop and that player meeting in Detroit, we say hello to Steve Burkowski. Burko, what can you tell us?
Good afternoon, Damon. It certainly has been a hot button topic, especially in the month of June. Everyone was looking at yesterday's meeting and had the chance to catch up with Webb Simpson, one of those in that meeting, a player director on the PGA Tour Policy Board. He shared his thoughts on what transpired in that meeting on Tuesday.
The full independents and player directors were there. We go to all of our board meetings, but we discussed everything, anything from tournament regulations to obviously the news of June 6th. But I think it was a very long, productive, optimistic meeting. I think everyone's encouraged at the information presented, and we have a long way to go. But it seems as if we are all on the same page, and our job as player directors is to do what's in the best interest of the members. And we've heard from the members a lot the last 3 weeks, I believe it's been. And the player or the independent directors are doing a great job with their ideas, listening to us, working with us. So it was a great meeting.
How hard is it to sort of comprehend all of it with so many moving parts? And as you said, so many people looking to you to say, what do we need to know? What's next?
It's a tremendous undertaking. There's so many ideas, so many opinions. I'm not speaking on behalf of the board, but on behalf of the membership, and those are needed. We want to hear from the members. So every chance I get, I'm asking members, whoever it is, whether it's on the trailer or the range, hey, give me your ideas. Give me your thoughts. What can we make better? Because that is our job as player directors, is to make the tour a better place for the members. And we care deeply about our sponsorships, care deeply about fans, care deeply about all of our partners, charities. But we got to do this the right way, and I think we're off to a great start.
What do you think the next logical step is in terms of more information, time frame, knowing that this isn't going to happen overnight or next week or next month?
We don't have forever. I think working fast and working hard is to our benefit, and I think we have to we're not going to be waiting around till November to the next board meeting. We're going to be on the phone quite a bit coming up. But we would like to start just chopping away. And there's so many parts of this that we have to look at and make sure it's in the best interest of the players in the tour. But we're going to do that, and we're going to work hard.
What's your one big takeaway from yesterday's meeting?
My one big takeaway, I had a lot of takeaways, but my one big takeaway is that this is a great opportunity for us. And I think an opportunity that could position us in a really awesome place for years to come.
You listen to Webb Simpson, there is reason, at least from his perspective, to be optimistic, a lot to comprehend, and maybe almost that sense of urgency that things need to pick up in terms of pace. That's his perspective. Also on the range in the putting green here this morning, talked to a handful of players, what they heard about the meeting. Here are some of the responses. Some said, we didn't even know there was a meeting yesterday. Another said, I would love to give you an educated opinion, but in order to do that properly, I'd actually need to know exactly what's going on. So many players, they feel lost, frustrated in terms of the lack of transparency. And then another multiple winner on the PGA Tour that's been out here for 15 years said, it's easy to look back in the rearview mirror, but he said, what if they actually, and I say they, the PGA Tour, took a meeting 3 years ago to get a sense of what potentially the PIF and the Saudis and everyone was looking for in terms of creating LIV and all the parts that surround it. How much easier maybe it would have been in 2023. Also followed up that individual by saying it's somewhat hypocritical now, the hard stance that the tour took on so many different levels that we won't do this, we'll never do that. And 12 months later, Damon and Eamon, it seems like the PGA Tour is doing exactly that.
Players, media members, so many of us trying to make sense in this uncertain time. Thank you, Berkel. Look forward to your conversation with Ricky Fowler next hour.
Well, fresh off the Women's KPMG PGA Championship, another big week is looming. The U.S. Women's Open begins at Pebble Beach Golf Links next Thursday, July 6th. Coverage on the networks of USA, NBC, and streaming on Peacock.
Flash back to just more than a year ago in 2022 when Anna Davis at the age of 16 fired a final round 69 to come from behind and win the Augusta National Women's Amateur. She'll be teeing it up next week in the U.S. Women's Open at Pebble Beach after making it through final qualifying at Valencia Country Club in California. Youngest Augusta National Women's Amateur champion. There you see the age, the 2021 U.S. Junior Solheim Cup team member, 2021 Girls Junior PGA champion, made the cut at the 2022 Evian Championship, and Anna joins us on this Wednesday. You know, Pebble Beach means something to everybody, to the golfer in Scotland or the golfer in Wisconsin, but you're a California native. What does Pebble Beach mean to you?
Exciting that I get to play a tournament close to home. I don't get to play a lot of golf on the West Coast, so being able to play U.S. Open, you know, just like a 2-hour plane flight away is pretty nice. So I'm very excited for that. I haven't been there before, and I've just heard the area is absolutely beautiful. So I'm very excited.
Anna, you played the U.S. Women's Open last year, so this is nothing new to you. Mm-hmm. So what are your expectations when you head into the week? What do you think is going to be a good week for you at Pebble?
I'm not really sure. I think we'll see when I get there. I don't know much about the golf course, honestly. I've seen parts of it, obviously, from watching tournaments there and things like that. But I don't know. I kind of, we'll see when we get there. And then I'll set some expectations for myself.
You've played a reasonable number of LPGA Tour events now and major championships. Are you finding yourself noticeably more comfortable in that setting than you were earlier in your career?
Yeah, for sure. I think even last year when I was playing on tour, just like the final few events that I played, I felt a lot more laid back and I felt a lot more like comfortable, and I kind of knew what I was doing, and I knew it was going to happen in the week. So that makes me like very excited for this upcoming week. Just because I kind of know my way around, and I, you know, I know how to prepare for these things. So yeah, I think I'm definitely a lot more comfortable, I would say, than I was last year.
And I have played Pebble Beach a handful of times at a much different level than you're going to play, at a much lower level than you. But small greens, seaside Poana greens, how comfortable do you think you are maybe making those adjustments? I know you say you haven't played a lot of West Coast golf, but small greens and seaside Poana, what's your comfort level with that?
Yeah. I think I'll be all right. I mean, I play golf in California. I live here. So I think it won't take a lot of adjusting to, but I've heard the rough is thick and, you know, the greens are small. So I think chipping around the greens is going to be difficult from what I've heard. And obviously hitting those tiny greens is going to be difficult. But I think just in the beginning of the week, you know, I get to prep obviously the week before. And so I'll probably just be working on those things, kind of getting used to the different grass, you know, kind of picking a smaller target just because those greens are so small, things like that. So.
You're number four in the world amateur golf rankings, Anna, and you haven't even actually started college yet. And you've had a high profile win, obviously, with the Augusta National Women's Amateur. Have the burden of expectations grown on you to something that's uncomfortable, or is this game still pure fun for you?
I definitely think last year I definitely felt like the pressure and the expectations of other people a lot more than I do now, but I've kind of, you know, like I've definitely gotten comfortable with the idea that, you know, people have expectations for me more than they did anyways a year ago. And so I think now it's more exciting for me to, you know, see people talking about me on social media and not really think of it as a bad thing. Kind of think of it as, you know, these people, you know, they believe in me and they think I can do well, sort of like that, instead of, you know, these people are going to be disappointed when, like, you know, I'm not at the top of the leaderboard. So just like kind of changing my mindset a little bit with the expectations and, you know, the pressure. I think if anything, I put more pressure on myself than other people do. So.
Well, Anna, it's interesting. I thought you handled your victory at Augusta National Women's Amateur with great aplomb and comfort, and you seemed to have a lot of swagger and cool. But even when you missed the cut this year because of the penalties, you also handled that situation, mm-hmm. in my opinion, with great calm and level-headedness. How would you describe kind of your mental strength and your ability to let things kind of roll off your back?
You know, golf is a learning experience every day, every tournament, you know, you learn something new. Unfortunately, at NY, I learned something pretty big. But I think, you know, you kind of just have to realize that golf is a learning experience, and, you know, that's why we play the game. But, you know, to me, everything is just like, I don't know, for me, everything is, you know, it's not that deep. So it's like, that's kind of my motto. That's kind of, how, you know, I go into events. It's like, okay, you're just here to play golf and, you know, to try your best every single time you play, and that's all you can really do. So,
you start college next year, Anna, and you've committed to Auburn. How does a kid from Southern California end up in Alabama?
I wanted something different than the California scene. I never really wanted to stay in California or stay on the West Coast. And so I always really enjoyed like the atmosphere of the SEC. And so my brother was looking at Auburn, and Auburn had always been interested. And so I went on a visit there and just ended up loving every single thing about Auburn. And I don't know, I went on my visit and I just didn't want to leave. And that's kind of how I knew that was, you know, the school that I was going to go to.
Anna, you're so composed. You're a high school student. There are books behind you. Harry Potter, Percy Jackson. What do you read and do in your downtime?
I don't know. I do like very laid back things. I'll watch Netflix or read a book. I don't know. I read like so many random books because my dad has so many. As you can see, there's literally like a library of books right here behind me. So whatever is in there, I'll like try and read. But yeah, very like chill things, like nothing too major.
Well, golf is serious enough, but you make it look easy. Anna, have fun next week at the U.S. Women's Open at Pebble. We'll speak to you again soon.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, a little later, we're going to talk to the winner of the Travelers Championship, Keegan Bradley. But coming up next, we'll have the man who tied for second, Zach Blair. He's making a comeback from injury, so Sunday was a pretty big day for him too. He'll explain that one next.
Golf Central Update, brought to you by Callaway Golf.
Zach Blair had himself a Sunday at the Travelers. Here he is at the short par 4, 15th to second.
Snuggles that one up there. Made the putt for birdie.
Yeah, different ways to play it. How about the par 3, 16th? Gorgeous day in Cromwell.
We saw the ground game from Zach on the last shot. This one is all through the air.
Nearly jarred it, setting up another birdie in a round of 62. That T2 finish at the Travelers, the best of his career. He won the Ellie Mae Classic on the Corn Ferry Tour, All-American at BYU, and can retain full PGA Tour card with 26 points. His next 7 starts, and great to have Zach Blair with us on this Wednesday. Buddy, great playing. I want you to brag a little bit. You shoot 62. What was the best shot or best string of shots that you hit on Sunday?
Oh, man, I kind of had it going on the back 9. You know, I hit a really good 3-wood on 13 in there to about 5 or 6 feet. But, I mean, the next kind of hour after that, I hit a really good one on 16 like you guys showed. But, I hit a lot of good shots that day. It's always fun when that happens.
Zach, you're playing on a major medical exemption now after an injury layoff. So you had a certain number of FedEx Cup points you needed to meet to get your status secured. And you went a long way towards that with 245 points on Sunday. Was that on your mind during that final round, or did you manage to put it to the side because you couldn't really influence it to any great degree anyway?
I mean, it's always kind of, you know, on your mind. I mean, at least for me, I definitely tried my best to just go play golf and not worry about it too much. But I mean, definitely coming down like, you know, 16 and 17, 18, it's kind of like, hey, every shot's really, really important at this stage. You know, it's kind of getting expensive. And, you know, the points are so dramatically different, you know, when you're tied for 3rd to 5th and 6th and so on. So, I really tried to not worry about it too much, but I was definitely thinking about it for sure.
Well, Zach, you missed a lot of time, 21 months recovering from this shoulder surgery to fix a couple of tears in your labrum. What was the rehab like? Because we can see the pretty golf shots now, but I imagine there were some tough, dark days just putting your body back together.
Yeah, I wasn't great about my rehab. You know, I would say I probably could have done better with it, but it was just kind of a lot of time at the physical therapy place, getting stretched out, especially, you know, after the surgery. So, it took about 6 or 7 months to really be able to pick up or swing a golf club again, but feeling pretty good now, which is always a good thing.
Zach, you weren't exactly doing nothing in that time because you've been building the tree farm outside Aiken, South Carolina, your dream golf course. What percentage of guys in the locker room do you think have a genuine interest to the level you do in golf course architecture?
I would say it's, a little more popular than people think. There's always guys that are kind of asking or talking about, golf course architecture or cool golf courses. And I think it's just gotten a little more, I don't know what the word would be, but, with social media and everything in the last handful of years, it's a little more normal, I think, to think that stuff is cool and be interested in it. So I would say maybe 30%, and the other 70 are just kind of like, they play golf because they're good at it, but they care much about the other stuff. But, it's always fun talking to the guys that care about it and, want to know what the cool place is around.
Another player who's very much interested in architecture and designs courses, Jeff Ogilvy. And I asked Jeff once if he only played the courses on tour that he was actually engaged by the architecture, how many would he play? And he struggled to get past 4. How difficult is it for you to separate courses that you're intellectually interested in or engaged by versus you're just there to work?
I feel like I'm really good at it. I can definitely shut it off and just say, hey, we're here playing a golf tournament, I'm going to do the best I can. And I've always felt like I can kind of play good anywhere. I've had good weeks at, places that you would think I would have good weeks at, like the Valspar. And then I've also had good weeks at places where, a shorter hitter typically wouldn't have a good week at, like Torrey Pines or something like that. So I've always felt like I can do a good job of shutting it off and just focusing on the actual tournament.
Well, Zach, I know you love architecture so much, but I read that before the Travelers, you played Eastward Ho, Fisher's Island, and Wingfoot. I mean, that's a bucket list trip. If true, please tell me, and did that inspire your great play in Cromwell?
Yeah, you know, early on in my career, I definitely went out and played a lot of cool golf courses during the week, especially because I was never in the Wednesday pro-ams and, you know, kind of had a day off and wanted to keep playing. So it was something I did a lot, you know, my first handful of years, and haven't done it a lot in the past, you know, this year or maybe the couple of years leading up to when I was hurt. This specific, you know, last week specifically, I was like, hey, there's a lot of cool courses in the area. We should go play a few. And I remember texting my friend on Wednesday, just basically being like, hey, I'm not saying I'm going to play good this week, but I'm really excited to kind of get back to the tournament course and, you know, kind of get ready for this event and play some tournament golf. And I don't know, for me, I just love playing golf and love seeing cool places, and it kind of filled the tank up for me. And, you know, something that it's never bad going to play, you know, those types of golf courses. It's fun, and, you know, get to go hang out with my friends and other people.
I'm with you, Zach. I just played Waikakil. Arthur Hills had his hands on it. Donald Ross, Tillinghast, more recently Crenshaw and Coore. Who's your favorite golf architect outside of yourself?
I mean, I'm a big Seth Rayner and CB McDonald fan, but honestly, kind of any of the golden age, you know, architects, I always, you know, feel like they did such a good job and built, you know, some awesome golf courses. But, you know, you mentioned, you know, some other ones like, Coore Crenshaw and Gil Hands and Tom Doak, and, you know, they've done a lot of really cool things and done a lot of good work on old golf courses, kind of restoring them. So there's definitely kind of a nice shift in the last 10 or 15 years, kind of getting back to that golden age influenced by that select crew.
We mentioned earlier in passing the Tree Farm, your golf course down in South Carolina, mm-hmm. Zach. What was the motivation behind it, and where exactly is this dream project at now?
I mean, the motivation behind it was just I had seen a lot of really cool clubs and golf courses and wanted to build one, and, you know, tried to do it in Utah for a while and wasn't able to really kind of get it going, but definitely learned a lot along the way those handful of years, and, you know, took all that stuff into this Tree Farm project in South Carolina. And, you know, it's just 30 or 40 minutes outside of Augusta. And, I mean, it was just a really cool project with a lot of very talented people that have made it a special place.
The way Eamon's talking, it sounds like he wants to sit on the crew and help you out.
Even Zach's fairways aren't big enough.
Okay,
for me,
maybe not. Hey, Zach, thanks for the time, buddy. Drive safe and have a great week in Detroit.
Yeah, thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
All right, Zach Player on a Wednesday. When Golf Today returns, the newest winner on the PGA Tour got the better of Zach just by a little bit. Keegan Bradley joins the show after setting records at the Travelers. What's next for Keegan as he prepares for this week's Rocket Mortgage Classic? And Keegan Bradley joins us now. Keegan, when you're old and gray and playing from the senior tees, what will you remember the most about last week at the Travelers?
Walking up 18 with a 3-shot lead. That was, of all my wins, I've never been able to experience that. And that was just so unbelievable. It was a dream of mine since I was a little kid, and still gives me chills thinking about it.
What did the win mean so much to you, Keegan? Was it the fact that it's just difficult to win out there, period, or you hadn't won in America in 5 years, or the New England thing, or a little bit of everything?
A little bit of everything. You know, this tournament, that tournament was always a tough one for me, especially my first couple of years on tour, because I wanted to play so well, so bad, and it made me play horrible. That's what's so weird about this sport. And it's taken years to get to a point where I can you know, let myself play like that in this tournament. And for it now to be an elevated event in the field that it had and 20, 30 family members there, it was just, it's literally what my dreams were. And it's surreal to be able to live out an experience like that.
Keegan, I remember talking to you during your bachelor days. You were a solo artist. You said, you know, when you thought about not being number one, you wanted to tear your own head off. That was your quote to me when I was writing for SI. How are you different now as a father, as a husband, winning golf tournaments and having a little crew run out to you on the green?
It's the greatest feeling I could ever experience. It's funny, I never thought of what it was like, going to be like to have a family. So this is all such bonus for me. And to see the look on my wife's face, Jillian, just even days after, she's just still, she's just the best. And she's still excited. And we're still, like, we text each other, like, can you believe that happened? Or someone sends us a picture that we, you know, of us all hugging, or, you know, a memory from that week. And, you know, it's literally what dreams are made of. And, you know, it's fun for me to look out at the people in my life and see the joy and the excitement of this win. It's even better than the feeling that I have.
It's so interesting to hear you talk about what it means in terms of the family context and even in terms of achieving those childhood dreams. Keegan, we hear a lot these days about money in golf. It seems to be the one topic of conversation. Sunday was the biggest paycheck of your career. Did it ever enter your head at any point during that day how much you were playing for?
So it popped into my mind a couple of times, but it was very minor. It was, you know, I definitely thought about it, but, you know, the weight that tournament holds now, I mean, this is a big tournament with the field, and I think it was the strongest field of the year, and the crowds, how loud they were, how big they were. You know, it had a bigger, sort of a more of a buzz than the U.S. Open even had. And, you know, coming down to the magnitude of what I was fighting the feeling all day of that walk up 18 and my kids running down. And that's what kept popping into my mind. And that was the feeling that I had to keep pushing away, because as I'm getting later in the round, I'm thinking, like, this is going to happen. Like, you're going to get to experience this. This is going to be the best moment of your career, maybe. And so that was sort of the battle that I had, was fighting off what inevitably happened on 18.
Keegan, we're all fascinated by your friendships with the likes of Michael Jordan, Aaron Rodgers, but as an athlete, what do those friendships mean to you in terms of benefiting you inside the ropes?
Yeah, I mean, just being around Michael Jordan is inspiring. He's just, he's something about that guy. He's got something that everyone else doesn't have. And forget about even talking to him about sports, mindset. Being around him, there's something there, and I'm so lucky to be able to have met my heroes. I've been able to grow up and not only meet my heroes, but call some of them friends, and it's something that I just can't believe sometimes, and it's friendships that I'll cherish forever.
So how many pairs of Air Jordans are in your collection now? We know he famously told you he doesn't have any Air Keegans in his collection, but how many of his shoes do you have?
He's got some. I have, it's embarrassing because I got to have close to 1,000, I would bet. I'm on a shipment that they send, so it's pretty horrible. I have to get a storage unit just to keep them all. It's one of my favorite, you know, sponsorships I've ever had. It's just a fun thing, and to be a part of the Jordan brand, it's with the history of him, and, you know, sometimes when I need a little boost, I look down and I see that logo on my shoe and think, like, what would he do here? Like, what would happen right now if he was in my shoes? And it's a cool thing to have.
Speaking of shoes, you were wearing your Ryder Cup shoes December of 2014 after that disappointing Ryder Cup. I bumped into you and said, hey, nice shoes. And you said, hardly used. You'd only played 3 sessions. It was a very heartbreaking Ryder Cup for you and the Americans. What's it been like having to sit on the sidelines of the Ryder Cup with the opportunity, perhaps, to go back in Rome?
Yeah, I mean, there was a point in my career where I thought I was going to play in every Ryder Cup, you know, years, decades of them. And then there was a point not long ago where I thought, this is never going to happen. No matter how much I want it, no matter how much I feel like I could help the team, like, I'm not in this conversation. And that was difficult. For me, watching the Ryder Cups, like, I've missed a couple Masters, and I've been able to watch them. The Ryder Cups not being there was the toughest. So I put myself in a real position here to be on this team. And the teams that I've been on, they're all gone. All the players are gone. So this would be a completely new team. I'd almost be a rookie on this team. And I just look forward to it. These new younger guys out here, they're such good guys, and they genuinely want what's best for their other players. And I just would love to experience that.
You've earned your place in the discussion, Keegan. Congrats on the big win in Connecticut, and have a great week in Detroit.
Thank you guys so much.
Let's flash back to 2004, Belle Reve Country Club. Peter Jacobson had just spent 6 weeks on crutches after undergoing hip surgery, but in the final round, fired a 68 at the U.S. Senior Open to win the victory. He became the second youngest winner of the championship and the seventh first-time winner in his first Senior Open. And the bio of our buddy, Golf Channel analyst, a seven-time winner on the PGA Tour, a couple of senior majors, a couple of times representing the United States Ryder Cup team, and the 2003 PGA Tour Comeback Player of the Year. And Jake joins us now from Century World. It's great to see you, buddy. I understand you're out on the golf course. I can recognize one of those tarps behind you. I don't know a lot about Century World. What should we know?
It's a legit golf course, Damon. I'm right behind the 16th green. You can see the tarp behind me. This golf course is almost a throwback to U.S. Open days. The rough is unforgiving. It's treacherous. It's about 4 inches thick, but it feels like it's 5 to 6 inches, to the point where if you miss a fairway, you're just chipping balls back to the fairway. So the key here this week is driving. You've got to put the ball in the fairway or you've got no chance.
Thick rough, chipping out sideways, got to put it in the fairway. You can tell it's a USGA event. Jake, you won this 19 years ago. You held off Hale Irwin by one stroke when he was demonstrably the best player in senior golf even then. What did it mean to you to win a national title?
It meant so much, Eamon. I had been playing in USGA championships since I was a junior, played in U.S. juniors, then I played in U.S. amateurs, and then I played in U.S. opens. And my first chance at a U.S. senior open, I was fortunate to win. I just think when you have USGA champion beside your name, I think that is incredibly special. It is the group, the organization that manages golf, that runs golf in this country. And it's more about pride and accomplishment than anything. And I know you hear people say that, not about the money, it's about the win. It is all about the win, especially our national championship.
Jake, how are 50-year-olds different now than they were 20 years ago? Padraig Harrington running through the door, Steve Stricker not missing a beat, Stephen Alker, you know, he's ready and rested. How would you compare this era of newly minted Champions Tour player compared to your era?
I think the body mass is different today than it was back when I was playing. We see kids coming out, I say kids, 50-year-olds, that come out on the Champions Tour now. They've maintained their fitness. And I think it was Langer that said it. It's not a club out here. It is about staying in shape, going 3 or 4 rounds, depending on the event. Have it a long ways, you're not going to have much success out here anymore. So we're seeing a lot of flat bellies. I know that's a term that people use for the PGA Tour, but we're seeing a lot more flat bellies out here on the Champions Tour today, more than we've ever seen.
What are you expecting this week, Peter? Is it going to be the same two guys who dominated this week and last season on the PGA Tour in terms of Padraig Harrington, Steve Stricker? Or do you think there's a potential surprise winner out there?
Eamon, I just don't see a surprise winner this week. Now, I could be totally wrong, but when you've got the length, let's face it, Padraig Harrington's a different player now than he was when he won his major championships on the PGA Tour. He's got a spark. He's got something that he's figured out. He's longer. He's stronger. He drives the ball so far. I think sometimes he averages 20 to 30 yards longer than the second place average player out here in any tournament. But I think you're going to see the guys that are long and accurate off the tee. Ernie Els, Retief Goosen, Steve Stricker, Jerry Kelly may not be as long as anybody, a hometown boy, and he's a fighter. So I don't see any surprises popping into the top 10. I think you're going to see the usual suspects because this is a legit golf course. It's long, it's hard, and the rough is so penal that if you don't keep it in play, you got no chance.
Jake, I'm curious what senior majors mean to PGA Tour champions players. You were so close on the regular tour, 6 top 10 finishes, a couple of thirds in the PGA Championship. How much did winning the U.S. Senior Open allow you to sleep a little bit better, a little bit easier? Have you come to terms a little bit, you know, easier with your playing career?
Well, let's not forget, I did win the U.S. Open in Tin Cup, which was a tremendous win. I just had to hit one shot and beat Kevin Costner, who we know is a solid 14. But we have 5 major championships out here, and it doesn't matter if you're 30, 40, and when you turn 50, it's still competition, and the intensity burns out here. And that's why it's fun to watch Padraig Harrington play the way he's playing. He is a different player. And when we talk about Els and Stricker and Retief, and it's just so much fun to watch these players, even though they're over 50, when you see them coming down the stretch on the last 9 holes in a major championship, you can see it in their eyes. It means so much to them. And look, Langer could win his 46th PGA Tour Championship this week. So there's a lot of storylines here, but I think the big storyline is going to be all about the golf course. It's going to be very reminiscent of the U.S. Opens and the days of old.
Peter, you've been around this game, it feels like, since old Tom Morris was a boy. But, you know, it's never been more volatile, this game, than it seems these days. And since the PGA Tour's deal with the Public Investment Fund was announced a couple of weeks ago, we've seen a couple of veterans weigh in. Tom Watson raising some objections about it. Davis Love asking everyone to kind of pump the brakes a little bit on it. What's been your reaction to this announcement?
Well, as you know, I used to date young Tom Morris's mom. So I'm not as old as old Tom. But I'm more in the Davis Love camp. I believe in our commissioner, and I believe in our individual representatives, and I believe they've got the best interests in mind for the PGA Tour as well as the game of golf. So I know it's confusing right now. Everybody's pointing this way and that for what's going to happen, but the game of golf will survive. The game of golf will go on. The PGA Tour is the best-run professional sports organization in the world, in my opinion. It's been good to me. The game of golf has been good to the communities in which we play and to the charities that we support, and they have supported us. So, yeah, I would pump the brakes. I would say, let's see how this all shakes out, because the game of golf will live on and survive just well, just fine.
Have the players lost the plot, Peter, in the sense of having an idea of what their commercial worth is that far exceeds what their market would actually support for these guys playing what is really a niche sport? Have they just kind of lost perspective on what they ought to be playing for?
The one thing that I disagree with, Eamon, is the pursuit of money. It's the disease of more. We see it in other sports, and I hate to see it start leaking into the game of professional golf. If I were the major championships right now, I would cut my purses to zero. Because let's face it, we're trying to play for claret jugs, U.S. Open trophies, and green jackets. And I know a couple of players said, wow, if they don't raise the purses on the majors, maybe somebody will skip it. Okay, show me. Let's lower the purse to zero, and let's see who doesn't play. I just think that players care about resumes and putting their name on trophies and putting those championships by their resume, on their resume, and to add to their legacy. So I just don't like this pursuit of money. It is not about money. I know LIV was all about money. Why would anybody go to LIV other than for the cash? And that's a really important thing. If you want the cash, take the cash. But right now, out here on the tour and the Champions Tour and the LPGA Tour, it is about championships and competition. And I think it always will be.
Jake, it's also about sponsors. And you've talked a lot about that through the year, the relationship that the players have when they're shaking hands in pro-ams. And no greater example than the AT&T Pebble Beach Pro-Am. Are you concerned about the state of sponsorship, just in terms of this back and forth that we've had, and even with this, you know, framework agreement that the sponsors are going to be, if not left behind, at least kind of at the back of the pack in terms of what's truly important in professional golf?
That's an excellent point, Damon. And back in 94, I was playing with Arnold Palmer in the Shark Shootout when Greg Norman presented his idea for this world tour. And Arnold got up and walked out because he said, look, this would be bad for the game. It's going to be bad for the sponsors, bad for the charities and the communities in which we play, because it's going to confuse people as to what we're really doing out here. So, yes, I'm concerned about the sponsors and the great people that support this game. But I hope cooler heads prevail and we get back to the track of just playing competitive golf and raising money for the charities we represent.
Well, Jake, a national championship will be handed out on Sunday. So glad you're on the call. There's a Culver's in Stevens Point if you're interested in a good burger. Have a great week, and we'll catch up with you soon.
You got it. Thanks so much, guys. Keep up the great work.
All right. The great Peter Jacobson. And I tell you what, I've always considered him one of the wisest oracles in the game, in part because he speaks so much to the soul of the game, the importance of history as opposed to money, and the importance of relationships.
What do you think of this idea of put the major purses back to zero and see who decides to stay home?
Because
there have been players who have publicly said that majors need to keep pace with this financial arms race that we're seeing in golf. And Peter's saying, let's go the other way. Let's roll back the purses instead of rolling back the ball.
I've got three highly active, distracted children at home that want to run around and play tennis and basketball. But when those 4 weeks come on the golf calendar, they want to chip and putt, and they want to watch golf, and they ask me, who won the major? How many major? I mean,
they don't ask you what they won first, though,
they
right?
They want to know who's going to put the green jacket on, Dad. That's what this game, I mean, you know, listen, are we living in a fairy tale? I mean, listen, I know obviously money is a part of it, but, man, we can't forget about the beauty and the soul of competition and what those important symbols, the claret jug. I get goosebumps just saying it, and we get to walk around it when we go to Hoylake and see it there on the practice range. And those are the yellow scoreboards. I mean, let's not forget the beauty and the history and some of the nostalgia that this game evokes.
Wouldn't it be wonderful to see a major championship returned to the idea of what the trophy is and get away from the money conversation entirely? Chairman Ridley, over to you. Well, John Feinstein has authored some of the most memorable books on this game in recent memory. His latest is Fegherty, a biography of one of golf's most interesting characters. John will be here to talk about it next. John Feinstein is one of America's most respected sports writers and has authored more than 40 books, including A Season on the Brink, A Good Walk Spoiled, and Caddy for Life, about the late, great Bruce Edwards. His latest book is titled Fegherty, The Remarkably Funny and Tragic Journey of Golf's David Fegherty. The book covers the highs and lows in the life of one of our sport's most popular figures, from his interactions with superstars to his addiction battles and the death of his son, Shay. We're pleased now to be joined by John Feinstein, one of America's most prolific sports writers. John, what drew you to David Fegherty as a subject for this book?
Good question, Eamon. David Fegherty. I've known him since 1993, when I first met him at the orientation session for Q School graduates. He had come to the United States, even though, as you know, he'd been a very successful player in Europe and being a Ryder Cupper. But he had to go through qualifying school and orientation, and that's where I first met him. I was doing A Good Walk Spoiled at the time, and then got to know him a little better when he finished fourth at the Open Championship a year later at Turnberry, the one Nick Price won. And we became good friends after he'd gone to TV. He was very involved in a charity golf event that Tom Watson and I put on to raise money for ALS research in Bruce Edwards' name. And the more time I spent with him, the more I was convinced that his life story was a book. And it proved to be even more true than I thought after we sat down and talked at great length, obviously.
Yeah, John, it's one thing to be a friend with someone. It's another to do research on his life story. What did you learn that surprised you along the way?
Well, how I think his wife Anita's description of him on their first date, David showed up drunk. As you know, he's an alcoholic. And she got up and left after he put a straw into her drink and drained it and still agreed to go on a second date with him. And I said, why, after that first date? And she said, because I sensed a kindness in him, even drunk. And I think that's why David's gotten a lot of mulligans in life. And that's a great description, because David has a personality that is impossible not to like if you spend any time at all with him, even 5 minutes when he's drunk. You've seen that throughout his career. One of the stories in the book, as you know, is about him getting arrested at Augusta National after accidentally driving his car onto the par three golf course one night when he'd had too much to drink. And he was in Ziploc handcuffs, and they called Jack Stevens, who was chairman of the club at the time, and said, what do we do with this guy? And Jack Stevens said, yeah, just let him go, because he liked David Faraday. I mean, how many people do the members at Augusta actually like?
John, we all know this kind of the charm that David has on a one-on-one session, but how does the public image of David Faraday in the minds of the average golf fan square with the private reality of David Faraday and all of these kind of dark passages he's gone through in his life?
Well, Eamon, David is very much an introvert. He likes spending time alone. He likes his privacy. When you go with him to a restaurant, he would rather sit either in a private room or with at a table with his back to the rest of the room. But when people do see him, do notice him, whether it's in a restaurant, at a golf course, in an airport, he acts as if you're his best friend. He's one of the things both his surviving children, Rory and Aaron, told me is the thing they're most proud of isn't that their father's famous or that he's on television. It's the way he treats people he doesn't know, people who, quote unquote, are not important to him. And I've been with David in a lot of those circumstances where people come over for autographs or selfies or to tell a story about where they were when David did something. And they walk away thinking David's their best friend in life. It's not a unique skill, but it is a very unusual skill, especially for someone who is by nature introverted.
John, you mentioned David's surviving children. He, of course, lost his son, Shay, several years ago to an overdose. How difficult was it to delve into that difficult time of his life?
Well, it was very difficult, even for me. And I'm not Shay's father. David is not over it. I don't think he ever will be. I don't think any father or mother who loses a child ever gets over it. He is, by his own description, a sadder person today because of Shay's death. He told me that he spends part of almost every day just crying, thinking about Shay, what he would have been today. His 35th birthday would have been next month. It's been very hard on him. It was very hard for him to talk about it, to remember that day and the aftermath, but he did it willingly. He didn't try to back away and say, oh gosh, I can't talk about that. He did as best he could because he doesn't remember everything. Fortunately, Anita, his wife, and his two other children do remember everything quite vividly and were remarkably candid with me in talking about it. In fact, Rory sent me a copy of the eulogy that he wrote for his brother, which is heartbreaking to read.
Writing about someone who's dealt very publicly with addiction issues can be and it's not an easy task for a writer, John. How did you have to approach how you did the job when you're dealing with subject matter like that?
Well, it was easier, Eamon, because David is so open about it, as you said. It's not like he was trying to hide certain things or say he wasn't an addict. And he talked about his addiction to cocaine in the 90s. And the way he describes himself today is that every day is a white knuckle ride to stay sober. And I know a lot of addicts can relate to that. My mother was an alcoholic. So I think I had a better understanding of what his life is like because of that. And he was, as I said, he was very candid with me, and that made my job a lot easier. It certainly wasn't a subject I enjoyed as much as David telling all the funny stories that are a part of his life, but it was something that had to be part of the book. One thing he said to me very early on when we were talking, when he told me the story about the Masters, and I said, do we really want to put this in the book. Because remember, David's my friend. I wasn't going to do anything to hurt him with this book. And he said, if we're going to do this, we're going to tell the whole story. We're not going to leave holes in the story. And he lived up to that from beginning to end, including when I had to go back and rewrite the last two chapters of the book because he went to live.
John, the book is fantastic. I read it a couple of weeks ago and absolutely loved every page. Thanks so much for your time and congratulations on the book.
Thank you, guys. Thanks for having me. Always good to talk to you.
As we go to break, another look at John's latest book, Faraday, The Remarkably Funny and Tragic Journey of Golf's David Faraday.